Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. This is Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and music. I'm Jorge Salazar.
Deborah Burr joins us now to talk about the global night sky and also to explain to us about what's being reported as a supermoon. That's a full moon closest to Earth in 18 years, happening on March 19th. Now, we've heard a lot about the supermoon after the devastating earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan on March 11th. Deborah, welcome.
Hey, Jorge. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for joining us. So, Deborah, what is a supermoon?
Well, people have just begun using this term, supermoon. I had never heard it before this week. A supermoon is a moon that is full and also at its closest to Earth. Now, the moon comes close to Earth once a month in its orbit, but they're using this phrase supermoon to describe a moon that's very, very, very close to Earth. For example, the March 19th full moon will be closer than it's been in 18 years.
And just to be clear, it is an astrologer that actually coined this term, supermoon, and it's made the rounds in the news lately because of this possible connection between this moon and an earthquake. What's happening here, Deborah?
What happened was that a website called Psychic Connection actually was the first to predict that the supermoon on March 19th would cause earthquakes, severe weather, volcanic eruptions, flooding, all kinds of stuff. And then, of course, the very tragic earthquake occurred on March 11th, the earthquake that struck near Japan and the subsequent tsunami that hit Japan and that spread throughout the Pacific. And oh my gosh, the supermoon theory just took off that day on March 11th, and people all over the internet were talking about the supermoon and its possible connection to earthquakes.
I mean, just to be clear, there is no scientific evidence that this closest full moon in quite a while has any connection to causing earthquakes, is there?
Well, two things to remember here. The first thing is that the Japan earthquake took place on March 11th. The supermoon is not until March 19th. So that's the first thing. The March 11th earthquake did not take place at the time of a supermoon. In fact, on March 11th, the moon was at right angles to the Earth-Sun line, and we should talk about this a little later about what makes it a supermoon and why they think there's a connection to earthquakes. But in fact, on March 11th, the moon, Sun and Earth were not aligned, and the moon was not at its closest to Earth. Therefore, it was not a supermoon. Therefore, no connection.
So, Deborah, tell us about the March 19th supermoon. Why do you suppose people think it might cause earthquakes?
Well, there's actually, some logic behind that. The moon on March 19th is full, and every full moon is lined up with the Earth and Sun in space. And at such times, the gravity of the moon and Sun reinforce each other, causing what are called spring tides. And people who live along the coast are very familiar with the cycle of spring tides and neap tides, which go along with the moon phases. So the moon's gravity does affect the Earth. It not only affects the Earth's oceans, but it also affects the solid body of the Earth. There are Earth tides that are known to scientists. So there's logic behind the thought that a full moon that's closest to Earth, its gravity is pulling more strongly on Earth. There's a logical thought behind how that might cause earthquakes. But in fact, if you look back in 1993, the last time the full moon was closest to Earth, as close to Earth as it is on March 19th, there were no disasters.
And just to come back to the point you made earlier that on March 11th, when there were disasters from this giant earthquake that struck Japan, the sun, the moon, and the earth were not aligned.
Correct. So 1993, when the sun, earth, and moon were aligned and the moon was closest to Earth, nothing happened. March 11th, 2011, when the sun, earth, and moon were not aligned and the moon was not closest to Earth, we had a giant earthquake. So those two facts should tell you that the supermoon theory there is some logic behind it, but there's no evidence of any kind. It just doesn't bear out in reality that the supermoon is causing earthquakes.
So let's talk about something that will happen. On March 19th, there's going to be a spectacular full moon. What's happening there?
Oh, it's going to be a beautiful full moon. It'll be the closest full moon since 1993. In 1993, the last time this happened, people were very focused on the brightness of the moon, and there were a lot of stories in the media that year about, you know, people were arguing, would the moon look brighter because it was closer to Earth? And astronomers were saying, no, it will not look brighter. And others in the media were saying, yes, it will look brighter. And I remember getting up the night of that 1993 very close full moon and looking out my window and saying to myself, wow, that's a bright full moon. So I don't know if the moon was actually shedding more light because of its nearness to Earth. Of course, that light is sunlight, reflected sunlight. I don't know if the moon's closeness and slightly larger size in our sky, in fact, will cause the moon to look brighter on March 19th. But if you have a clear sky that night, it should be a beautiful full moon, as every full moon is very beautiful, and this one should be a beautiful moon as well.
And we also, people listening who get a chance to see that full moon won't be able to see anything like this for a while, right?
That's right. Of course, there's a full moon every month, and we can see a beautiful full moon every month, but the moon won't be this close to Earth again, as close as it is on March 19th, 2011, until November 14th in the year 2016.
Well, thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
See the moonlight through the dark.
On today's Weird Science, Ryan Britton has a story about an industrial engineer with an innovative design for a prosthetic or artificial arm. She designed an artificial tentacle. Ryan, what's up?
Right. She designed a tentacle like an octopus has. So, you know, we might see people with upper limb amputations sporting tentacles to wrap around objects. You know, we might follow this one under cool science or awesome science because, you know, it's really a pretty stunning invention.
It kind of makes sense. Octopi and squids are very adept at grabbing objects.
Right. Kayleen Cao, she's a graduate of the University of Washington's Industrial Design Project. She participated in what's called the UW Design Show this year, 2010. Her and some of her fellow students explored new ideas for prosthetic arms, ideas that work better than what we have today. So, Kayleen came up with this idea of a tentacle where two motors pull wire through a device to curl a tentacle up and straighten it out again. It's a really simple design that's definitely stylish and could be very reliable.
So why a tentacle versus just a hand?
Well, to give you a little bit of the backstory, Kayleen Cao's advisor, it's a professor by the name of Magnus Fell, had a friend who had a prosthetic arm, and you know, it just didn't work that well. So he challenged Cao and her fellow students to find ways to make a better prosthetic limb. There was some interesting insight that came as a result of their work. What they found was that it doesn't always make sense to try to create, you know, a hand with fingers. What's more important is to look at the interaction between the prosthetic arm and the working biological hand. So Cao designed this lightweight tentacle that opens and closes slowly enough so that the user can have time to put an object in the tentacle's grip.
pictures of this are really amazing.
That's right. That's right. And to really appreciate the story, you know, I would suggest going and looking at the pictures on the internet. You can find some at cnet.com, but make sure to go to a website at uwdesign2010.com to see the other prosthetic limbs that were you know, created by some of Cow's contemporaries. They're all pretty interesting.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Weird Science with Ryan Britton. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. This is Earth Sky. Emily Howard joins us now to talk about deforestation, lasers, Google, and how they all came together for Earth's tropical rainforests. Emily, what's happening?
Well, let me begin with deforestation. Deforestation, that's a big deal when it comes to discussing climate change because trees store carbon. And when forests are cut down, that carbon goes into the atmosphere as CO2, which is a greenhouse gas that's linked to global warming. I spoke with Dr. Greg Asner of the Carnegie Institution for Science in Stanford, and he recently surveyed the Amazon rainforest in southern Peru, an area about the size of Switzerland, to understand and create geographical maps of how much carbon is present in the trees there.
If you were to take all of the carbon that's stored in all tropical forests and you were to burn it all up, you would emit into the atmosphere about 5 times the amount of carbon dioxide that's already in the atmosphere. So it's a huge amount of carbon sitting in these tropical regions that, in terms of climate change, we don't want that carbon released into the atmosphere.
Dr. Asner says you can tell how much carbon a forest holds based on the size, height, and density of its trees, which brings me to lasers. In order to chart carbon levels in forests, Dr. Asner uses data gathered on the ground, as well as data gathered by lasers mounted on airplanes.
The core technology in the study involves LIDAR, which stands for light detection and ranging. We have a particular kind of LIDAR that we fly on an airplane that fires out of the bottom of the airplane and sweeps across the forest, measuring not only the height of the trees, but the three-dimensional structure as you pass down through the tree canopy and down to the forest floor. With that technology, we're able to image the forest in 3D, kind of like a CAT scan.
Technology such as LIDAR is an important way to gather information about forest density because it's hard to gauge how many trees are in a patch of rainforest when you look at it from above. Now, this is a catch that's often exploited by illegal loggers. People can actually go into an area and do some logging and go completely unnoticed if they leave enough trees there to create a canopy shield. And this brings me to Google. Dr. Asner recently teamed up with Google to create Earth Engine, and this is a place on the internet that brings together all of this satellite data and maps about the Earth's natural resources and how they've changed over time. And it's expected that this can be a useful tool in making policy decisions as well as monitoring illegal activities such as deforestation.
Space lasers to save forests, not science fiction.
Nope, it is not. This is science fact. And who knew that when humanity would finally get lasers into the jungle, it would be in the spirit of conservation.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Emily Howard. And we're Earth Sky, clear voice for science. This is Earth Sky. I'm Jorge Salazar. In late 2010, NASA announced plans to develop a mission to study the atmosphere of the planet Mars. It's called MAVEN, short for the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission, and it's scheduled to launch in 2013. On the line now is MAVEN's principal investigator, Bruce Jakosky. Dr. Jakosky, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Now, what is MAVEN, the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission?
Our mission is designed to explore the upper atmosphere of Mars. What we're trying to do is to look at how gases escape from the atmosphere to space. What we want to do is understand how the climate has changed, how the atmosphere has changed over time. And we think the evidence points to loss out the top of the atmosphere as having been a very important process in that history of climate. We're going to be the first mission to fully explore the upper atmosphere, and our goal is to learn what happened to the atmosphere. Where did the atmosphere go? Where did the water go?
Would you mind explaining a little bit about how that's done?
In this case, we already know that the atmosphere has changed over time. All of the missions that we've been running, something like a dozen or more over the past 25 or 30 years, have told us that water has been present on Mars, that early Mars, 3.5 to 4.5 billion years ago, had liquid water and probably that the water was stable, yet today's atmosphere is cold and dry. So we know that things have changed. What we want to do is understand why they've changed. The biggest difference is that we think that early Mars had a thick CO2-rich greenhouse atmosphere that provided warming. And the big question has been, where did the CO2 go? Where did the water go? It either went down into the crust or up into space. So our goal is to look at the amount of water, of CO2, that has been lost to space. You've asked a really good question about how we can extrapolate backwards in time. And we've devised three different approaches to doing that. The first is that we're looking at a time in the solar cycle when the energetic drivers of the atmosphere are changing. The ultraviolet energy that drives the chemistry and that drives escape and the solar wind are changing significantly at the time we're going to be measuring. So we'll be able to see the response of the atmosphere directly to those changes in the solar wind and in the sun. That's the first approach. We know what the sun was like in the past from studying other stars, so that immediately allows us to extrapolate backwards in time. The second approach is to understand the processes responsible for determining, for controlling the structure of the upper atmosphere and for driving escape. And then we know how those processes behaved in the past because we understand their response. And then finally, you brought up the point about looking in ice cores at the Earth. One of the things we look at on the Earth are isotopes. We're doing the same thing on Mars. We're going to measure the ratio of oxygen 18 to 16, of carbon 13 to 12, and so on. And in this case, the escape, each of those ratios is sensitive to the escape to space. The lighter isotope is lost more readily. So by measuring that ratio, we can directly determine how much gas has been lost over time. Together, these give us a very robust determination of what's happened to the atmosphere.
That was planetary scientist Bruce Jakosky. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. This is Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We interview the world's top scientists. Up next, a weather report on the science of forecasts. To scientists, weather is a daunting challenge because of its complexity. Small changes in one place can add up to big changes in another. Meteorologists rely on computer models to make reliable weather forecasts. And here to explain more is Ron Gilaro, lead scientist of atmospheric simulation for the Global Modeling and Assimilation Office at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. Dr. Gilaro, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Please explain for us, in a nutshell, what is a weather model?
A weather model is a computer program, a very complex computer program, that contains the equations and basic governing laws that dictate how different atmospheric parameters relate to each other, say how temperature relates to pressure, relates to winds, and most importantly, how these parameters or changes in these parameters in one parameter might affect the change in another parameter. So given a change in wind or pressure, how that might change the temperature. And this is our essential way of trying to understand the processes and the motions of the atmosphere.
Maybe you could tell us how scientists are doing in understanding Earth's weather and what are some of the challenges that keep them from completely understanding it.
Well, actually, our understanding of the weather is actually generally quite good, but it's also a function of the scale of the processes. We understand large-scale circulations, processes, and those sort of phenomena that are easy to observe. We understand those very well in terms of our physical laws. As it gets to more complex processes as they relate to clouds or smaller motions, those we understand less well. But the basic problem with the atmosphere is there is really an inherent predictability limit. The atmosphere is what we call a chaotic system. What that means is that it's very difficult to come up with a regular cause and effect sort of relationship. It doesn't always respond in the same way to small perturbations. So that means you can make what seems like a very small error in your depiction of the atmosphere at a given moment, and that could become a very large error in a forecast. It's a lot of people have heard of the butterfly effect, where, you know, there's this folklore that can a butterfly flapping its wings in Beijing cause a rainstorm in Brazil? Well, it's not quite that bad, but it is sort of an anecdotal way of expressing the property the atmosphere has, where what seems like a very small change or perturbation at one moment in time can lead to a very sudden and dramatic change a very short time later. That doesn't always happen, but it can happen. And unless we can model the atmosphere perfectly and observe the atmosphere perfectly, that's a limitation we'll never be able to get beyond. Now, we've made progress, but the atmosphere, for that reason, will never be entirely predictable.
That was Ron Gilaro of NASA. That's our show. Thanks for joining us on Earth Sky. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.